The detective commander, Harold Greer, had set up in Gus's tiny office behind the kitchen, and the team of detectives he'd called in was assembling there. Greer was on the phone, holding one finger in his ear as he explained the status of things to somebody from the mayor's office, while the detectives around the room watched him. Larry went over to Dan Liprinzer for the lowdown. Lip, who had the slicked-back do of a 1950s-style juvenile delinquent, was, as usual, by himself in a corner. He'd been the first stick on the scene and had interviewed the night manager, Raphael. Paradise closed only twice each year, for Orthodox Christmas and the 4th of July, the birthdays of God and America, the two things Gus swore by. Every other day, there were lines out the door from 5 a.m. until noon, with a slower trade in the remaining hours comprised of cops and cabbies and many air travelers coming or going from Disabled Field, which had revived when Transnational Air, TN, initiated regional service there a few years ago. According to what the night manager had told Liprinzer, Gus had come in to pick up the cash and send his employees home right before midnight on Wednesday, July 3rd. Each worker received $100 from the register. As they were about to hang the closed sign, Louisa Ramardi, who worked for Transnational as an airport ticket agent, had walked in. She was a regular, and Gus, who had a thing for every female customer, sent Raphael the fry cook and the busboy on their way and took over the kitchen himself. Sometime in the next hour or two, Gus, Louisa, and a third person had been murdered. The last victim was a white in his late 30s, tentatively ID'd as Paul Judson, based on both a run of the plates of one of the cars still absorbing the July sun in Gus's lot and yesterday's missing person report from his wife. Mrs. Judson said Paul had been scheduled to arrive July 4th on a 12:10 a.m. flight at Disabled Field. Raphael had returned to reopen at 4:30 a.m. today. He hadn't thought much of the disorder he found, assuming that once Gus got rid of his patrons, he'd walked out quickly rather than turn away new customers. Near 5 this morning, Mrs. Leonidas, Athena, phoned in distress because Gus hadn't shown up yesterday at their cabin near Skagen. Searching around, Raphael noticed Gus's Cadillac still in the lot and began to worry that the trail of blood near the register wasn't from thawing meat Gus had dragged upstairs to the kitchen. When the fry cook arrived, they called the cops and, after some debate, finally pulled the handle on the freezer in the basement on the chance someone was still alive. Nobody was. It was close to 3:30 p.m. when Greer put down the phone and announced to the 12 detectives he'd summoned that it was time to get started. He had a clipboard and began announcing assignments, so each cop would know his or her angle while examining the scene. Harold was going to run the case as a task force, receiving all reports himself. Larry tried to make his face plaster when Greer announced he was teamed with Wilma Amos. Wilma was your basic affirmative action item, whose highest and best use was probably as a hat rack. Worse, it meant Larry wasn't getting anywhere near the lead on this case. Instead, Wilma and he were delegated to background the female vic, Louisa Ramardi. "Guided tour," said Harold, and he walked out through the kitchen. Harold Greer was an impressive guy to most people, a good-sized, well-spoken black man, calm and orderly. The techs had taped off a path, and Harold instructed the digs to go single file and keep their hands in their pockets. "Working theories," said Harold. He was standing behind the cash register, which rested on a plate glass case whose angled shelves held stale cigars and candy bars. "Theory number one, which is pretty solid. This is an armed robbery gone bad. The cash register is empty. The bag for the bank deposit is gone, and each victim has no watch, wallet, or jewelry. Second theory. Today, I'm saying a single perpetrator." "That's soft," said Harold, "but I'm liking it more and more. The bullets we've recovered all look like 38 rounds, same bunder marks. One shooter, almost for sure. Could be accomplices, but it doesn't seem to play that way. Judging from the shoe prints and the blood and the drag pattern and the distribution of the post-mortem lividity on Gus's and Louise's corpses, Mr. Judson was forced at gunpoint to haul both bodies into the freezer in the basement." Harold led his detectives like a grade school class past the counter, where Muriel still sat, and through a narrow door. The stairway was lit by a single bulb, beneath which the group clumped down the wooden steps. In the brick cellar, they found a significant encampment. Three-wheeled stretchers were across the way, awaiting the bodies, which had not yet been removed, because they were frozen. The police pathologist, Painless Kumagai, had several tests and measurements to perform prior to allowing the corpses to thaw. Using a pen, Harold opened the food locker wider. Judson's body was right there, one leg in the doorway. Harold pointed out his shoes, both soles brown with blood. The tread patterns matched the prints in the trails upstairs. In their rubber gloves, Painless and his team were working on the far side of the freezer. After Mr. Judson had pulled the bodies into the food locker, he was bound with an electrical cord, gagged with a dish towel, and shot, execution style, in the back of the head. And then, I guess to celebrate, our hero sodomized Ms. Romardi's body. One of the pathologists moved aside fully, revealing Louisa Romardi's remains. Following the preliminary exam, they'd repositioned her as she'd been found, bent face down over a stack of 50-pound bags of frozen French fries. Above the waist, she was clad in Transnational's rust-colored uniform. Her matching skirt and her red panties had been jacked down to her ankles, and beneath the starched tails of her white blouse, the melonish rounds of her buttocks were hiked in the air, penetrated by the dark ellipsis of her anal sphincter, which had been distended at the time of death. Somebody had worked her over down there. There was redness, meaning, if Harold was correct, this had occurred right after her death, while a vital reaction was still possible. Rape kit is negative, but you find the top of a condom wrapper here in her drawers and what appears to be a lubricant track around the anus. Harold covered a few procedural orders, then headed upstairs. Larry remained in the freezer and asked Painless if he could look around. "Don't touch," Painless told him. Larry went to Louisa Romardi. When the pathologist okayed it, he climbed over the levee of bags to see her face. Louisa was pretty, soft under the chin, but with lovely high cheekbones. She was one of those Italian chicks Larry had known plenty, spreading out as she reached her early 30s, but not ready to stop thinking of herself as hot stuff. "You're my girl now, Louisa. I'm going to take care of you,"